Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to join us on Facebook at facebook.com/UNC Knowledge. facebook.com/UNC Knowledge. Put up questions, suggestions for guests, comments. Dr. David Berlinski is the author of many books, including most recently, 1, 2, 3, Absolutely Elementary Mathematics. 1, 2, 3 is about the peak of my own mathematical form, but the prose is so irresistible. I challenge, even if you're as much of a mathophobe as I am, you will not be able to put it down. An earlier book, and the book we'll spend most of our time discussing today, is The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions. We should establish your professional background is, you're a polymath, but it's mathematics. You're a mathematician. If you have to be one thing, we'd call you a mathematician. Isn't that right?
Certainly, if you feel free to call me a mathematician, but I would so much prefer being called a writer, because that's what I do with
that's
most
what you
of my
do.
Time.
All right.
As it happens, I write a lot about mathematics.
All right. Okay. I'm happy to do that. I can confirm that you're a writer. I couldn't possibly produce a testimony that you're a mathematician.
We're better off that way.
Right.
Better off.
Fine. Segment one, scientific pretensions. From The Devil's Delusion, quote, "A great many men and women have a dull, hurt, angry sense of being oppressed by the sciences. They're frustrated by endless scientific boasting. They suspect that the scientific community holds them in contempt. They are right to feel this way." Close quote. Explain that.
It seems to me that anyone living in the United States, or even in Europe, I mean, this isn't purely an American phenomenon, has this feeling that they're a group of experts, a band of happy experts. And as experts will do, they derive enormous pleasure from telling the rest of us how to think, what to think, what doctrines to uphold, what positions to defend. And this conspiracy among experts, if it is delivered in small, manageable doses, for example, in a doctor's office, one is generally happy to receive it. Doctors know what you're talking about. Yeah, take an injection, that's fine. But as a cultural, as a social, as an ideological phenomenon, it gets on everyone's nerves after a while. I mean, what headline in any newspaper is more apt to provoke a sense of aggression and disbelief than "scientists say"? I mean, you know what's coming afterwards. It's not the scientists saying anything. It's the political relations department of the scientific community, their publicity apparatus. They're telling the scientists what the scientists think they should say to the public. And within 24 hours, what serious scientists say has changed overnight. Look at the history of medicine over the last 50 years. One triumphant imbecility after another revealed to be a fraud. So there's a deep, and I think my words were well chosen, deep, hurt, perplexed sense of being oppressed by a scientific community that in many respects doesn't know what it's talking about. Not all, obviously not all, but in many respects. The boastfulness is what's so irritating.
And in this book, the particular form the boastfulness takes that you wish to refute is scientists saying, we've discovered that there is no God.
No.
And we know there's no God because we are scientists.
Exactly.
And you don't, all right.
Exactly.
Let me quote from The Devil's Delusion again, David. "In many respects, the word naturalism comes closest to conveying what scientists regard as the spirit of science, the source of its superiority to religious thought. But what reason is there to conclude that everything is, to quote philosopher Alexander Byrne, an aspect of the universe revealed by the natural sciences? There is no reason at all," close quote. Now, you need to unpack that for us, but my layman's stab at it is, the sciences properly construed have access only to the material world, what we can perceive through our five senses, and there's no reason to suppose that that encompasses all the world or all of reality. Is that the right way?
I think that's a good way. It's a partial way. Certainly,
partial.
I would reject the idea that the sciences have exclusive access to the material world. There are other ways of dealing with the material world. The Yankees don't train their pitchers in terms of material science. The development of the human body really is a part of the material world, but is not necessarily the focus of a group of science when we talk about performance in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other ways of accessing the material world. But the important thing is that these dominating terms, for example, natural, naturalism, when you try to look at them more clearly, they turn out to be inordinately spongy. There's really nothing under the term itself. I mean, we all know that to be natural is somehow to be good. It's like a Swedish nudist documentary, all natural. See any number of Swedes prancing on a beach, that's natural. Oh, all right, it's natural. But what does the word mean? What does the word mean? And why should we pay such serious attention to scientific propagandists who wish to insist that only this kind of inquiry makes sense? Makes sense scientifically or makes sense intellectually? After all, mathematics is a paradigmatic case of a science that has nothing to do with natural anything.
So what I'm, again, I'm trying to reduce this to a layman's term. What you're saying there is don't be overawed by someone saying, A, I'm a scientist, and B, I'm an atheist. Don't suppose that statement B derives any particular authority
from statement A.
That's what you're saying, right?
The comparable claim would be, A, I'm a scientist, B, I'm an expert on contract law.
Right, right.
Well, you're an expert on contract law because you study particle physics? Give me a break.
Right.
Expert on the existence of God because you studied particle physics? I request the same break, the same suspension of belief, the same absence of commitment to whatever it is you're saying. And these guys are, of course, shameless. They're just shameless.
David, two quotations. Atheist author Sam Harris, quotation number one. Religious faith is on the wrong side of an escalating war of ideas. Science must destroy religion. Close quote. Quotation number two from the Compendium of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Quote, there can never be a contradiction between faith and science because both originate in God. It is God himself who gives us both the light of reason and of faith. Close quote. Which statement strikes you as the most pretentious?
Well, the first certainly engenders a single reaction. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's Sam Harris.
Okay.
It's the sort of thing some of my college sophomores would say when they had read a little bit of H.L. Mencken. Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's go on to the next subject. The position of the Catholic Church is much more balanced, nuanced, subtle, and suggestive. I don't think it's pretentious at all. I think there's an enormous body of serious discussion behind it. I won't go so far as to say I endorse it wholeheartedly, but it's a reasonable statement. It comes much closer than anything Sam Harris is saying to capturing where we happen to be in the early part of the 21st century.
Segment two. Darwin.
Good old boy.
Good old boy. The devil's delusion. Quote. This is quite a quotation. It's only a few words, but it's...
packs a punch.
Yes, it does. Two of them, I think. Suspicions about Darwin's theory arise for two reasons. The first, the theory makes little sense. The second, it is supported by little evidence. Close quote. All right. Let's take those one at a time. Evolution makes little sense. Evolution is in the air. It's so widely accepted.
It's in the air of the New York Times, that's for sure. And it's in the mouth of every evolutionary biologist. But that doesn't exhaust the cosmos. Let me ask you a question. If those two propositions you were to accede were completely true, would it change your mind?
Those
are the two quotations.
That evolution makes little, the theory makes little sense in and of itself. And it's supported by little evidence. David, it wouldn't change my mind because I'm so completely on your side on this one.
Well, I mean, if you were on the other
side. If I were on the other side, yes, but I would do everything I could to, I mean, that's sort of like the vampire
but
approach.
But I assure it would change no one's mind. And
that's really
the curious thing about the discussion. Do you think it would change Richard Dawkins' mind?
Or Sam Harris? Why do you say that the theory in itself makes so little sense?
Well, what's it say? Whatever survives, survives. No, I knew that before.
Because it's
tautological. I didn't even have to study Darwin.
It's tautological.
It's empty.
It's empty.
It's empty. It doesn't tell us anything. Yeah, survives, survives. I'll believe that. But that's not a theory. That's just a string of wet sponges on a clothesline. That doesn't tell us anything deep about biological structure. Yeah, a lot of variations. Children don't look exactly like their parents, thank goodness. And their children will be slightly different too. But does that tell us why startling, complex structures arise in the history of life? No, it doesn't have anything to do with
this. It is supported by little evidence. Now that, I have to say, did startle me to hear you say that evolution is supported by little evidence.
What is the evidence that's forever being introduced? Well, there's
I can tell you. Little boy, Father took me to the Museum of Natural History in New York. There it is over on the west side of Manhattan.
Yeah.
And all the plaques say that said then what they say now, which is this dinosaur came at such and such, and is it such and such a period? And there are charts on the wall saying somehow or other how we got from those dinosaurs to creatures that are alive today. That's
not
the evidence.
Bad. And there are arrows connecting the creatures.
Indeed, there are.
Where were the arrows discovered? That the museum won't tell you. There is such a load of inferential adjustment made in even the most plausible evolutionary sequence. I mean, take a reptile to mammal. That's a beautiful evolutionary sequence. It looks like one organism is being slotted right after the other. And tremendously interesting changes where bones in the jaw migrate to become the three bones in the ear. The structure of the mouth changes completely. That's the best. Or the whale sequence, you know, some sort of terrestrial animal becomes a whale over roughly 9 million years. But that doesn't amount to an elaboration of anything more than the discovery of fossils that could be slotted in an evolutionary way. Could be. But what we lack is the analytic refinement to tell us whether they are or have been slotted in this way. It is simply an exercise in conditional plausibility. Yeah, it could have happened that way. No one on my side of the table is saying, no, it's impossible that it happened that way. What we're saying is that the evidence is remarkably, remarkably constrained, meager, insufficient, inadequate, and lacking all forms of analytic sufficiency.
Well, so I'm on your side, but your strength, but I...
Overwhelming you.
I feel the impulse to be on your side. I hadn't thought it through anything like this. So how is it that evolution, that Darwin comes along, and within what seems like 27 seconds, he's carried the field, that is to say intellectually, in the academy. He's just carried the field. By the turn of the 20th century, Darwin is the dominant way of looking at the evolution of species, the development of species. How did that happen? I mean, I can see that it's taxonomically useful, that it gives you a way of putting fossil bones in order. Now you have a filing cabinet. You understand what could lead to another. But surely there's more.
How did it happen that Marxism swept its field, swept it so thoroughly and completely that 100 million people had to die before someone realized, you know, that's not such a swell theory at all. That theory may have certain problems. Now, the same gravamen doesn't stand against Darwin's theory, but let's face it, academics throughout the Western world form a native conspiracy class, and they are very akin to a criminal class. They'll believe anything, and once they believe something, the conspiracy is held tenaciously. And for what were very good reasons, Darwinian theory was accepted in the academic world way before it entered public relations world, the world of the media, world of newspapers or television. And it was accepted because it was a form of power. It was an advantageous acquisition to be able to say, well, you guys out there in the Bible Belt don't understand a thing, but we understand life. Knowledge is power in the academic world, and that was a devastating acquisition, the more so since it allowed academics to participate in a cultural war against religion, a rival center of power.
Richard Dawkins, one of the most prominent atheists of the day, quote, although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. What do you make of that?
Well, it depends what they're filled with, doesn't it?
No, put the most charitable. What is he getting at? People respond to Dawkins. The books sell. That quotation, you just type in Richard Dawkins plus, and this quotation comes up 10,000 times on Google. Why do people respond to this?
Darwinism provides a mythological framework for a scientific theory. It provides an account of human origins. It provides an account of biological origins. It provides an account of change. And that account at every point is the substitute for a biblical account. That is, the accounts that we had all been led to believe, say, before 1859 were essentially biblical. They began, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Mm-hmm. To be an atheist before Darwin, Richard Dawkins is arguing, would be to leave unexplained the very point that the Bible or the Christian Jewish tradition does explain, the origins of life. In terms of that tradition, the origins of life occur because God breathed. upon inert, inactive matter and created life. For the first time, Darwin seemed to provide a framework in which that wasn't necessary. Or more precisely, it wasn't necessary in as far as an alternative miracle was available. That is the miracles currently being promoted for the origins of life.
It is a creation myth without a creator.
That's right.
All right. Segment three, Big Bang. The Devil's Delusion again. Scientists, the Big Bang and the Anthropic Principle, by the way, we'll cover both if we may.
Sure.
The devil's delusion. Scientist, the physicist Paul Davies has observed, are slowly waking up to an inconvenient truth. The universe looks suspiciously like a fix. The issue concerns the very laws of nature themselves, close quote. Explain that, if you would.
Well, Paul Davies is one of a number of physicists, certainly not the only one. Fred Hoyle, who was a very serious 20th century astrophysicist, came to the same conclusion. He said the universe looks like it's been monkeyed with by a super intellect. Things are so precisely coordinated. Numerical values for certain parameters are so finely adjusted, and if they were perturbed in any way, things would collapse, or the universe would become chaotic, or living systems couldn't arise, that we cannot conclude that this was all the result of any kind of accidental process. It's inherent in the design. But when we look at the laws of nature, nothing in the laws of nature suggests it must be this way. The design is inherent in the numerical parameters and certain properties we see in the universe, but we have no good account for this. The laws of nature are silent. They are what they are. They can work with any within any numerical valuation or range. So all of these guys, and there's Fred Hoyle, there's Paul Davies, Stephen Hawking once was talking about mm-hmm. this. Any thoughtful physicist will say, why is the universe the way it is? Why is the universe the way it is, precisely the way it is, when what we might expect rationally is a generic universe? Generic is a term of mathematics meaning what you would ordinarily expect, the most likely kind of case. And we're very far from genericity in the universe. We're a highly unlikely kind of structure we inhabit. And the question is, why is that? Now, one answer to Fred Hoyle is that the universe looks as if it were monkeyed with by a super intellect is, it was monkeyed with by a super intellect. Things were set up just so. Another answer is, we really don't know. It's one of the enigmas of modern science. A third answer is, there are many, many, many thousands, millions of other universes, and what is unlikely in this one may be likely when we consider all of them.
So how much the Anthropic Principle, the suggestion is, your suggestion is that it's reasonable to suppose that it was set up. That is to say, the laws of the universe are consistent with the notion of the Judeo-Christian idea of a creator who set it up. I think John Paul II said that man is the only creature that God willed for his own sake. So that if the belief is that this is all set up to produce human beings, that's consistent with what we see in the Anthropic.
Completely.
Okay. But you're saying only that it's consistent. You're not taking it a step further to argue that it is evidence or even suggestive that there may be a creator, because after all, again, the crude layman's attempt to grasp the argument here, you spin the roulette wheel and the ball falls on number 7, and you could spend the rest of your life saying, with all those possible slots, why did it fall on number 7? Why should that have been? Well, it was because it was. It was an accident, right? So you can't really get very far. You can't construct much of a proof of the existence of a creator. You can't.
No, you can't. But you can construct an argument, something short of a proof.
All right.
I agree, if the ball drops in the slot mark number 7 just once, you can say, well, and you get a big payoff. It's interesting, drop once. If it drops in number 7 again and again and again, at some point you would be entitled to scratch your head and say, you know, the game must be fixed, or I must be inordinately favored to be winning it like this. But I'm not going to say I'm lucky. That right. doesn't seem to me a perfectly appropriate answer. At some point, luck runs out, as we all know.
Right. All right. Now we move to the Big Bang. Again, I quote the Devil's Delusion. The best data we have concerning the Big Bang, the Nobel laureate Arno Penzias remarked, are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, the Bible as a whole. Close quote.
That's a wonderful, wonderful quotation. Now, this is one of the two people who discovered the microwave background radiation, for which he got a Nobel Prize.
This is a serious guy.
Yeah, he's a serious guy. And he didn't know what he was discovering. He was very lucky. He struck pure gold. He thought he was examining pigeon droppings on his antenna. And he finally found a nose, a signal from the microwave background radiation. But he, like many other physicists, initially confronting the facts of the Big Bang.
Which you'd better summarize for us. The Big Bang means?
That apparently the universe exploded into inexistence from nothingness around 14 or 15 million years ago, billion years ago. It's an occurrence for which we have no causal explanation. There are plenty of theories about it. There are plenty of attempts to go back behind the Big Bang and see what was going on behind it. But right now, one of the obdurate facts, one of the irremovable facts of cosmology is that 14 to 15 billion years ago, there was a universe, small, intensely hot, intensely compact, intensely curved, and before that, there was nothing. Not even space and time before that.
And the point is that fiat lux,
yes,
let there be light, is as consistent with the data as any other explanation.
It is precisely consistent with the data. It is a prediction, although not a quantitative prediction, that astonished the community of physicists in the 1960s, astonished Einstein in the 1920s when he realized the field equations of general relativity predicted an expanding universe. And Einstein understood right away if it's expanding, it's got to be expanding from something. And he rejected it. He didn't like the idea. He wanted a steady state universe lasting from all eternity, from one eternity to another eternity. But the Hubble data persuaded him he was wrong.
Okay, so again, we get, with the anthropic principle, it's not a proof.
No.
But it sure is suggestive. That's your argument. And the Big Bang, it's not a proof. It could be simply because it could be. But it is, I guess what I'm trying to do is to get you to distinguish between your judgment in these matters, between saying it's merely consistent with the Judeo-Christian view of a creator who brought it all into being, or you'd like to suggest that it points in that direction. There's something positively suggestive about it.
It's certainly moving and disturbing that in the 20th century, cosmology should have rejected an ancient view of the universe as moving from the everlasting to the everlasting with no origin, and embraced a completely different view, but one that is in no way new. It's part of the religious tradition. I think I would like to rest my commitment by saying this is strange, unexpected, moving, and very curious. Certainly, someone who objects as indignantly as I do to claims of having discovered a proof made by the likes of Dawkins or Sam Harris or the other scientists arguing in this realm with respect to the existence of God, I'm not about to say I've discovered a proof to the contrary. The language of proofs is appropriate to mathematics, not to a discussion like this. What is appropriate to a discussion like this is philosophical argumentation. And we cannot close the day by saying one side is definitively in possession of an argument so fine, so fecund, so powerful that it ends all discussion. They won't end. The discussions won't end. But a bit of balance would be welcome.
Segment four, where do atheists get their morality? On this program in 2007, an exchange, Peter Robinson saying to the guest, quoting myself here, if Christopher Hitchens does not believe in God, then where does he get his sense of right and wrong? To which Christopher replied, I think it's degrading to state that absent a celestial dictatorship, we wouldn't know right from wrong. I think our knowledge of right and wrong is innate in us. We know we can't get along if we permit perjury, theft, murder, rape. All societies at all times have forbidden such behavior. How does David Berlinski respond?
I'm not sure. I mean, I've heard Christopher Hitchens say the same thing. I'm not sure that so far as these particular asseverations go, there is any real point of dispute. I mean, I think it's true that we know right from wrong. At least most people do most of the time. That's hardly the question, is it? Knowledge of right and wrong doesn't take us very far. Why should we be right when we could as easily be wrong?
Well, what do you make of this, that Christopher's answer there redefines the common understanding of right and wrong? What he's really saying is useful and not useful, socially useful and not socially useful.
Look at the history of the 20th century and try to account for the history of the 20th century in terms of agreeable usefulness. It is an intellectual category of splendid irrelevance. Splendid irrelevance. I mean, Nazi executioners swabbing out the death cells from their loads of blood, or communist czars sending tyrants sending people to Siberia, to the Arctic death camps. They had no use for usefulness. They had nothing constraining their behavior in terms of the traditional apparatus of a celestial dictatorship. I think that word is fine, although there is some opprobrium attached to it. But that's exactly what human beings have always said. We need someone cracking the whip over us. Right.
So I take your discussion of morality and the 20th century and the devil's delusion to be another form of the argument that you make with the anthropic principle and the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. That is to say, religious people would say there is an objective right and wrong, there is a law of God, and if you don't obey it, terrible consequences will follow. And you make the point that terrible consequences
have followed.
Did follow.
Yes.
Right. So again, that's not a proof for the existence of God, but it sure is suggestive. That's what you're saying.
We could put it in the fashion of Christopher Hitchens. It's not a proof for the existence of God. It's certainly a suggestion about his usefulness.
Okay. So,
all the laws of heaven and earth, Dr. Johnson remarked, are unable to prevent man from his crimes. Surely relaxing the laws of heaven and earth shall not dispose man to better behavior. That seems to me self-evident.
All right. Now, David, it's impossible to discuss the horrors of the 20th century without mentioning the Holocaust. And you have a very moving dedication here in The Devil's Delusion to your mother's father, your grandfather. And you write the dedication in German, and it concludes in Auschwitz verschollen, missing in Auschwitz.
But much more to the point, disappeared.
Disappeared.
In Auschwitz.
Disappeared in Auschwitz, better translation. So how do you handle the datum of the Holocaust? In some ways, it's utterly elementary question. You may find it as a question uninteresting, but it's not easy to answer. If there were a God, how could such a thing happen?
It's a terribly difficult question. But look, if we take the period from 1939 to 1945, look at 1945. The Jewish people yet live, Hitler's target. The Third Reich, that lies smashed to smithereens under the tank treads of Russian tanks, or blown to bits by American and British airplanes. And everyone who survived the Third Reich must survive, drowned in mourning or consumed with grief. That doesn't strike me as a whole lot less than a biblical adjudication of those war years. Not pleasant, but no one reading the Old Testament comes away convinced that the God of wrath is essentially a Rotarian. He is a God of wrath. If he chose to kill 9 million people to make a point and then destroy their persecutors, remember Lincoln's second inaugural address, the conclusion he reaches. We must still say, as was said long ago, righteous and just are the decisions of the Lord. Mm. He was talking about a terrible war too.
In The Devil's Delusion, David, you construct a kind of syllogistic progression to show that this is another way you show that religious questions can be perfectly reasonable. Let me quote it to you. If the universe is contingent, there is no saying whether it existed forever. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe not. That's point one. Point two, if anything might not exist, then it is reasonable to ask why it does exist. Point two. And point three, well, why does it exist? I mean, really?
Yeah.
How does David Berlinski answer the question?
I don't think there is an answer in terms of the traditional body of knowledge we associate with physics. I don't think physics is now in a position to answer that question, and my suspicion is it will never be in a position to answer that question. But it is a very good question, and it is a question that, while it cannot be answered from the physical tradition, can certainly be asked from the physical tradition. And that's something very interesting, the existence of a class of questions that can be asked within a physical theory but not answered within a physical theory. And I think when you look at those kinds of questions, well, why does the universe exist? What are the causal conditions that make a universe possible? What are the necessary and sufficient conditions for bringing our universe into existence? Then you have the beginning of a sense of intellectual humility.
You're pretty sure that Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and even my friend Christopher Hitchens can't answer those questions?
Yeah.
All right. Segment 5, our final segment, alas, Taking Science on Faith. In The Devil's Delusion, you write, and I quote, "Western science is saturated by faith." What do you mean?
You run an experiment. You put your hands in your laboratory equipment. You go away for a cup of coffee. You take a nap. You come back. You expect the experiment to be continued, and that when you put your hands in the laboratory equipment, it will be the same. Things are continuous from one moment to another. The universe doesn't shake itself in and out of existence. Things are stable. Things are predictable. Things are satisfactorily amenable to investigation. These are all items of faith. How do you know any of these? You project backwards from the modern era to say what could have happened in imperial times, Roman imperial times. How do you know the same universe was there 1,000 years ago? You're going to leave this table in about 30 seconds. How do you know a chasm isn't going to open at your feet, Peter? You don't know that. You take it on faith. And there are thousands of remarks. These are remarks within the philosophical tradition pointing out the extraordinary extent to which, in order to advance scientifically, there's an enormous body of assumptions that have to be in place. And those assumptions can't be defended. No science, Aristotle said, ever defends its own first principles. And we can't either. It's just a logical point.
All right. Another quotation from The Devil's Delusion. "Members of the National Academy of Sciences are by and large persuaded that there is no God. Men and women in their millions that there is." Why should that be so?
There's a tremendous advantage in belonging to the National Academy of Sciences. And the National Academy of Sciences is an institutional source of authority and power. If these guys were going to defer to the Vatican or to a council of rabbis or to a group of Muslim clerics, much of their power and influence would be discredited. But that is to take a cynical view. The less cynical view is that a certain amount of education, a certain amount of immersion into a physical theory, and the same thing is true, immersion into a legal theory, tends to displace any other kind of ideological affiliation. And that is transmitted or transmuted into a form of denial. There is only one truth that happens to be the truth of plasma physics. That's what a plasma physicist is. And why not? 50 years studying plasma physics, that's the only truth you can see.
So you're suggesting that atheism, as it expresses itself among scientists, is a kind of déformation professionnelle.
Oh, of course. Of course. You find the same thing in people who are completely committed to wrapping Cuban cigars. That's how they think of the universe. The universe can only be illuminated in terms of a large cigar being wrapped. It's not a source of surprise.
The world of matter, again from The Devil's Delusion, revealed by the physical sciences, does not serve to endow materialism with a familiar face. There are black holes and various infernal singularities. Popping out of quantum fields, the elementary particles appear as bosons or fermions. Reality is remarkably Baroque, and it is promiscuously Catholic, small c,
yeah.
Catholic. So here, throughout this book, David, one place you stated explicitly, you state, "I do not take as the burden of my argument to prove the existence of God.
Right.
I take it only to demonstrate that the scientists cannot disprove the existence of God." Fine. And that's the way this book operates, that's a kind of baseline. You get that on every page. But there are other pages where if you were graphing the reader's reaction, intellectual reaction, there would be little spikes here and there in which it seems that you're saying more than that. It seems that you, well, right here, you say that science, physical science, properly understood, a true understanding of the physical, the material world around us, not only does it not mute or displace a religious sensibility, it excites a sense of wonder and mystery.
Well, I agree with that. I had no intention of concealing that. I know not seems, my lord. No, I agree completely. That is a position in the book that I do want to adopt. It certainly does, to the responsive mind, excite a sense of religious possibility. The passage about material objects that you quote is one intended to show the vacuousness of the material as a category, even within the heart of physics. There is no sense of a material object that covers the sort of inquiry that physicists are doing. Black hole is not a physical or material object. Look, you smack your hand on the table, and then you smack your hand on the table again. How many times have you smacked your hand on the table? Two. Where is that number two? Is that a physical object? No, of course not. And that pervades the sciences. The idea that the world of matter is the world that matters is simply not true. Or if it is true, and there's a wonderful remark by the logician Kurt Gödel in talking about materialism. Gödel was, of course, a great genius, and he had no patience for the physical sciences. And he said the only way materialism ever survives is that all of the properties that we would want from a non-material world, from a psychological or biological or religious perspective, are just slapped on top of a material object and we describe it as material. That's no answer. I mean, even the most primitive parts of physics, force. Is force a material something? We have a very limited understanding. Even 300 years after Newton, what is force? What is force? We don't know. What is energy? Are they material? It's hard to say.
Final question, alas. Let me give you one more time. Let me give you two quotations and just ask you to respond. Quotation number one requires a little bit of a setup. Late philosopher Sidney Hook, remarkable man.
Old friend.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
All right, I didn't know that. I never had the chance to meet him. He died a year or two before I came here to the Hoover Institution. Well, but Sidney Hook was an avowed atheist, not agnostic, but atheist. And a friend of his, this was a story told to me by that friend, said to Sidney Hook, Sidney, if when you die, you discover to your surprise that there is a God after all, how will you explain yourself? And Sidney Hook replied, quote, I tell God that he had provided insufficient evidence, close quote. That's number one. Here's number two, Psalm 8. When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, close quote. Which quotation, which worldview, do you find, to use Richard Dawkins' phrase, more intellectually fulfilling?
Well, I've heard Sidney Hook say the same thing.
Oh, is that an old line of Sidney's?
Yeah.
All right.
What are you talking about, David? There's no God out there. No, this is just a lot of hooey. I'll have a tuna sandwich. there's very little substance in that quotation. And of course, there is a point of presumption in that particular argument, which Bertrand Russell also used. The point of presumption is that human beings constructed as human beings are constructed could so interact with God as to be persuaded by the countenance of the deity when they were left unpersuaded by the evidence of his handiwork. That's a remarkable presumption. Much more reasonable, it seems to me, is those who cannot see the handiwork will not be able to see the countenance either. There is a limitation, a kind of aspect blindness at work. Not everyone appreciates Mozart. It's just a fact. The second quotation, I think, is a beautiful quotation, but there's a fine line from Gerard Manley Hopkins. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod. I think that captures very elegantly the spirit of the psalm, but also something of Sidney Hook. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? That's something I always ask Sidney. You know, we did talk about that. He thought it was a New York imperative to be very tough all the time. But what he thought in his heart of hearts, that he kept to himself.
Actually, I want to ask, this is going to be the final question. So we know that this program is watched disproportionately by kids, basically, college kids. Mm. So you have somebody in college who's going to, I don't know if you went through this when you were an undergraduate. You being you, you probably went through it at the age of 7. But it's the sort of thing that I went through when I was an undergraduate, which is you show up at college and you look around and you realize that a lot of very bright people are atheists. And since most people, just numerically speaking, come from these millions and millions who do believe, to assume the existence of a God, there can be a really quite disorienting moment. And given your, given the various proclivities, the time, the course interests of the student may wish to investigate this in as rigorous a way as an 18 or 19-year-old can. What advice would you give to such a student?
To investigate the question?
Yeah, yeah.
I would suggest to any student entering college now, 2011, do what I'm sure he hasn't done. Go read the Old Testament. That should be your first challenge. You know, I always ask my students, "Malathi, have you read the Bible?" "Oh, yeah, I've read the Bible, sure." But when I interrogate the students, it turns out reading the Bible means they have a Bible on their bookshelf. I said, "Have you opened it?" "Yeah, we've opened it, but opening it doesn't mean reading it." The Old Testament is the greatest repository of human knowledge and wisdom in the history of civilization, any culture, any time, any place. And that really should be the first point of discussion, because every attitude current today in the discussion, from Richard Dawkins to me, to Christopher Hitchens, to lonely pastors in the Bible Belt on Sunday morning ranting from a particular text, is discussed in the Bible. And there's a character in the Bible who expresses that point of view, and there's sympathy expressed for that point of view, and there are reservations expressed by the sympathy. And it's an enormously complex, rich, dramatic piece of work. That's the first.
All right. David Berlinski, author of The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Peter Robinson for Uncommon Knowledge. Thanks for joining us.